Site at amomentofscience.org, where you can also view videos and sign up for podcasts. For A Moment of Science, I'm Don Glass.
Albert Pujols was expected to rejoin the St. Louis Cardinals lineup today, but his return has been pushed back at least one more day. He was originally slated to play first base, then was moved to designated hitter before becoming a late scratch against the Washington Nationals because of a sore back. The three-time National League MVP has missed the last three games as a precaution. Pujols took his normal turn in batting practice before the decision was made to pull him. The Cardinals also scratched outfielder Matt Holliday from the lineup after he experienced soreness in his right rib cage following batting practice. A spokesman for the team said Holliday is day-to-day. Daniel Hudson gets the start for the Chicago White Sox this afternoon as they take on the Oakland Athletics, and Ben Sheets, who is making a comeback after elbow surgery. The White Sox are 2-3-1 in Cactus League play. An opening day starter, Carlos Zambrano, makes his second spring appearance as the Chicago Cubs take on the San Francisco Giants at home in Mesa, Arizona this afternoon. Zambrano struck out 1 over 2 innings in his first outing March 5th against the Diamondbacks. And the Chicago Blackhawks host the Los Angeles Kings tonight. That's sports.
I'm Diane Adams. My friends call me Dee Dee. I was born blind. My husband worked with visually impaired older folks. He would talk about the radio reader. He'd say, I ordered this radio reader for so-and-so, and so one day I said, I would really love to have one of those.
At the Illinois Radio Reader, local newspapers, books, and magazines and periodicals are read and recorded by over 70 volunteers, and then those programs are broadcast to those visually impaired people who have our radios in their homes.
It is literally our newspaper. I feel we as visually impaired people are so privileged to have a service like this. I'm Dee Dee Adams from Decatur, and WILL is my source for the Illinois Radio Reader.
It's 2:42. Some corporations report they have work for people but can't find people with the right skills. At the same time, some laid-off workers are being trained for jobs that don't exist. Emily McCord of member station WYSO visited a community college in Dayton, Ohio, that's trying to address the mismatch.
Casey Wilson is standing in an expansive white room wearing a lab coat and safety goggles. She's holding a piece of woven fabric. It is glue on one side, and she's sticking it to a big metal bracket. She's learning how to make a composite. If this doesn't feel much like the typical classroom, well, that's because it isn't. It's a college course being held at Vector Composites, a startup research and manufacturing business that makes parts for aerospace and defense systems in Dayton.
All of a sudden, I got to go fill a parking lot full of cars. I don't have people to go hire because they don't exist in Dayton.
Tim Brocklehurst is the manager at Vector Composites. And while he wants to hire new workers, he's struggling to find people who can do the job.
You know, here we are with folks that have high school level educations. I've got a PhD in materials engineering that's teaching this class. We took us like 5 attempts to get this curriculum into something that someone without the exposure can understand. That's difficult.
Casey Wilson used to work at a local tool and die company before she was laid off. She says this school experience is a completely new one for her.
They could have really taught this way above our heads, and they made a great effort to bring it down. I felt like we actually learned.
Wilson can expect to make about $14 an hour in this field once she completes her training. But let's back up a bit here. This class represents a shift in approach. In 2006, Sinclair Community College officials launched a study that changed the way they thought about job retraining. It found that there were both a lot of unemployed residents here and a lot of jobs going unfilled.
And people would say, well, just have those unemployed get those jobs. How simple, right? Just have them get those jobs. Well, part of the complexity was the skill set didn't match.
Deb Norris is with Workforce Development at Sinclair. The college used stimulus money to create programs for students who want jobs in manufacturing but needed a little help to get those jobs. So Tim Brocklehurst gets his employee trained in composites. Casey Wilson betters her odds of getting a job. Everybody wins, right? Well, Norris says, not everybody.
There is still very high potential earning power. You just have to have a different set of skills.
Not everyone is able to get hands-on training at places like Vector Composites. There are prerequisites, and many students need to take remedial classes before progressing. So getting a job in manufacturing can take almost as much schooling as, say, getting a job in information technology, or in Eddie Miller's case, as a social worker.
We've been so working on using our physical means to do a job, and now we're being thrown into doing a mental part of the job, and it's becomes just an incredibly difficult thing to do.
Miller made trucks at General Motors before he was laid off just over a year ago. He has to take some entry-level classes, and he thinks it'll take some time to finish school. While he's fine with that, he worries about his former GM assembly line colleagues.
I don't know what's going to happen to the people. I don't know what's going to happen to me. It's going to take 3 years. Well, most of the people are going to be burnt out by then, or can't afford to go, or they have to worry about their mortgages.
Deb Norris at Sinclair College understands that frustration, but she says the job landscape is just dramatically different now.
The beauty of General Motors for a number of years was that they paid very, very well. And not only was the pay, but the benefits were just outstanding. And that was a beautiful, beautiful thing. But it's not here any longer.
For Eddie Miller and others like him, that's a tough reality. Miller says he has friends who've already given up on school, but he's not going to. Even though it may take a few years, he believes it's his best chance to find and keep a good job again. For NPR News, I'm Emily McCord.
Next, we turn to one of the Obama administration's less talked about initiatives, the Smart Electrical Grid. It's supposed to open the way for new sources of green energy. Among the hurdles facing the initiative, how to link big cities with renewable sources, which tend to be in rural areas. One Canadian company has unveiled a multi-billion-dollar plan to feed power from huge hydro dams in Canada to New York City and Connecticut. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports those electric cables will be hidden underwater.
A ferry sets out across Lake Champlain, a big slate-gray wedge of water that runs between upstate New York and Vermont. This has been a shipping lane for hundreds of years, feeding iron and timber south to New York City. Now a Toronto company called TDI wants to use the lake and the Hudson River as a new kind of superhighway, not for cargo, but to feed electricity to the northeastern U.S. Donald Jessam is TDI's president.
You'll have four cables coming down Lake Champlain into the Hudson, directly into New York City. And then two of the cables continue on over to southwest Connecticut.
The cables will be buried under the sediment, carrying about 2,000 megawatts of power from hydro dams in Canada. That's about the equivalent of two nuclear power plants.
Literally, once this cable's buried under the waterways, it's essentially maintenance-free.
Buying all that green power from Canada could help northeastern states hit carbon reduction goals. The new cable could also help prevent grid failures like the massive blackout in 2003 that affected eight states. Andrew Phillips is a scientist with the Electric Power Research Institute, an industry group with no ties to the TDI project. He says a big advantage of this approach is that it avoids running new power corridors through forests and communities.
Getting rights of way is a large challenge for anybody running any power line across the United States or anywhere in the world, actually, today.
TDI uses a kind of direct current cable technology that's more efficient, Phillips says, at carrying electricity long distances. This would be one of the longest, most complicated underwater transmission lines ever attempted.
380 miles of cable is an enormous length. Nothing even close to that length has been done in the United States, if not worldwide.
According to TDI, the technology for laying the cable has already been tested. A video on the company's website shows the line being buried under the sediment using remote submersibles.
If a major obstacle is encountered, the cable guidance system navigates the best cable path using sonar and cameras.
If the engineering is tricky, the project will also have to navigate one of the most historic waterways in the country, with more than 300 shipwrecks in Lake Champlain alone.
They date from the 1700s to the French and Indian War, the Revolutionary War, the War...
Adam Kane is an archaeologist with the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum, which has been hired by TDI to help research a route that won't get tangled up in all that history.
There's also going to be a series of archaeological surveys that will make sure that there aren't any sites that we don't yet know about that are impacted.
The project is also drawing scrutiny from environmental groups. A much smaller cable project built across Long Island Sound in 2002 drew fire from activists worried about damage to shellfish beds. Leah Schmaltz is with a Connecticut-based group called Save the Sound.
most of the projects that have traversed Long Island Sound have been having a tough time complying with their permits in the end. So concerns from habitat destruction, permit compliance seem to be pretty strong.
TDI has already begun the permitting process with state and federal regulators. The company hopes to begin construction in Lake Champlain in 2012, with all that power flowing underwater by 2014. For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann.
It's 10 minutes before 3 o'clock. Songwriter and guitarist Patty Larkin is known as a musician's musician, and she got 25 of those musicians to play on her new CD, which is aptly called 25. That's also a reference to the number of years since Patty Larkin's very first recording. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
Patty Larkin and her guests collaborated a little differently for this album. Instead of working their duets out together in a studio, Larkin recorded her voice and guitar tracks for each song on her own and sent them to the different musicians. And she gave them total freedom.
They were able to do whatever they wanted.
For the song Beautiful, Patty Larkin sent files to singer-songwriter and guitarist Aaron McKeown.
I opened them up, and there was a standard sheet of paper that she'd sent to everybody describing the project. And at the bottom, it said, "Here's Beautiful for your voice." And that was it. And it was up to me to interpret that cryptic remark. So I just kind of went crazy on it.
We were walking in the park, and it was not the zoo, I know.
Aaron McKeown on Beautiful. She just sings all the way through with me, and she does her own thing.
I thought, oh, the chorus needs something, so I'll just add an organ. No big deal. She can take it away if she doesn't like it.
And then she highlights what I'm doing, and she plays Hammond B3 and piano. And I had no idea she played keyboards.
You looked beautiful. You looked beautiful.
Patty Larkin says there were other surprises. Martin Sexton whistled. Jonathan Brooke played toy piano. Larkin got the idea to invite guest artists last year, at a time when she really needed her community. Her mother passed away last fall.
She was sick for about 3 months, but she passed away in September. And I remember playing some of these songs for her as she lay dying and saying, you know, Mom, I'm going to get some friends to play with me on these songs. And, oh, remember this one? And I was kind of pulling out songs from my first albums and newer ones as well.
Larkin says her mom didn't want her to be alone.
She was my biggest fan. And I wanted to make her happy. Like, I'm going to be okay. I am going to call somebody. I'm not sure who I'm going to call, but I'm going to call some people. I know a couple people.
Another one of those people was David Wilcox, a singer-songwriter based in Asheville, North Carolina. Patty Larkin gave him a choice which song of hers he could play on.
I think Patty sent maybe three that she thought would really work well with my voice.
Wilcox settled on the song Cranes.
On their wings they are returning. On their wings they fly. Shadows fade, the sun is burning high.
I was asking, so do you want to like trade verses? Do you want it to just be harmony? She said, whatever you want. And it was so fun to have that kind of openness because it makes you come to the song for your answers.
And only love can.
The folk music world is pretty big and very connected. Patty Larkin has worked in person with all 25 of the artists on her new CD. They've bumped into each other at clubs around the country or played on each other's albums.
Somewhere I found the strength, probably from my mom, you know. I found the strength to be able to ask people to join me.
Patty Larkin says her only regret is that it wasn't her 50th anniversary, since there were so many more of her friends she wanted to include. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Alice in Wonderland has needed much protection through the years, and not just from the strange characters she meets in Wonderland. As commentator Amy Guida explains, one battle over Alice pitted creativity and marketing strategy.
When I say Alice in Wonderland, what image immediately pops into your mind? If you'd been a lawyer for Walt Disney Studios back in the early 1950s, you wouldn't have stopped long to ponder the answer to that question. That's because at Disney, everyone knew that the Disney version of Alice in Wonderland was pretty much the only answer. You know the one, the sweet blonde-haired, blue-dressed, white-aproned Alice, the grinning purple-striped Cheshire Cat, and the linebacker-like Queen of Hearts. The once solely textual Alice in Wonderland, Disney lawyers argued, had magically become the Disney version of Alice in Wonderland in our collective consciousness. Lewis Carroll? By that time, his work had become a part of the public domain, and his words, quite frankly, Disney believed, didn't hold a candle to the blonde cartoon girl. Disney's vision had become America's vision. Disney lawyers had gotten involved because at just about the time that Disney was about to release its cartoon version of the Lewis Carroll classic, and after it had spent much money on both the making and the marketing of its film, another film company announced that it, too, was about to release a version of Alice in Wonderland. The second film, as Disney would surely prefer it to be called, featured puppets and a human being who played Alice. It was a French production that also began with a live performance. When the French film dared to announce that it would open in a New York City theater just about the same time as the Disney version, Disney lawyers became as mad as hatters. By this I mean mad as in angry. Disney immediately filed a lawsuit to stop the showing of the second movie. Disney had spent a lot of money to make sure its cartoon was a success after all, and it didn't want some French film riding on its coattails. Alice in Wonderland now had a secondary meaning in the United States, Disney argued, because of Disney's strong marketing plan. Disney was merely protecting its own Alice, or better put, the only Alice, as would McDonald's protect Ronald McDonald, or so the argument went. But by mad as hatters, I also mean mad as in not thinking straight. The courts didn't appreciate Disney's attempt at shutdown. Lewis Carroll's work was in the public domain, a lower court reasoned, so all could make their very own versions of Alice in Wonderland, and it would be stifling creativity to stop them. Imagine Shakespeare, one court hinted, with only one interpretation, the one backed by the most bucks. So no, the courts decided, Disney couldn't put a halt to rival productions of Alice. When I say Alice in Wonderland, what pops into your mind immediately? Today it could well be the Tim Burton film. And while that may signal a new Alice consciousness in the United States, that would be perfectly fine with the folks at Disney. Not because it's had a change of heart legally, necessarily, but because Tim Burton's film is a Disney production. I'm Amy Guida.
Earth and Sky.
Certainly, scientific knowledge and technical information is critical for informed, robust decisions, but it's not the whole picture.
That's Melissa Finucane, a Honolulu social scientist who recently conducted a study on how farmers and ranchers in Hawaii perceive and act on environmental risks. She interviewed people who, over the years, had been affected by drought. Finucane found that only some of them use scientific information, from the internet, for example, to understand and cope with drought-related issues. She said her study helps explain why people respond the way they do to natural disaster.
And why that might not be consistent with the recommendations that come out of technical risk assessments.
In other words, why communities facing risk sometimes disregard scientific advice. Based on her interviews, Finucane believes that, in the Pacific region at least, the science related to drought and other environmental risks should be complemented with a narrative, that is, with the retelling of a relevant and useful personal story.
It's also more compatible with the local tradition that we call talk story.
In her region, she's shared what she learned so far with the Pacific organization PRIMO, whose aim is to help vulnerable Pacific communities stay resilient in the face